I don't know if there's a better song to sing right before a sermon than that one. We can do all of them again if you want to. And I don't think you can sing it sitting down. I don't know. I don't think that's scriptural. But neither here nor there. The meeting we have coming up, I'm supposed to make a statement about it because I honestly forgot to make a statement about it anyways. So Russ stopped me. He said, say something. I said, okay, I will. So Jeff Wilson will be here at the end of this month. We need to remember that. It'll be a Saturday night and a Sunday. Jeff does an excellent job. I've never actually met him, but I've heard him preach a few times, and he does a very, very good job. So mark that down. Be looking for it. The 27th and the 28th this month. February, we're discussing Jesus as man. And of course, our theme this year is more about Jesus, and as we hope to learn more about him, that we might be more like him. This month, Hebrews chapter 2 and verse 14. You don't mind saying it with me. Inasmuch then as the children have partaken of flesh and blood, he himself likewise shared in the same, that through death he might destroy him who had the power of death, that is, the devil. If you'll open your Bibles to Hebrews chapter 2, Hebrews chapter 2, and place your bookmark. That's where we'll spend the last little bit of the sermon, is Hebrews chapter 2. And we're going to be looking at several different passages throughout the gospel accounts this morning as we try to discuss Jesus. I'll freely admit to you, this has been one of the more challenging lessons I've worked on. The reality of God becoming man in order to save man. It was never a question if he could, because the God we read about in the Bible is certainly powerful enough to do whatever he wants to do. But the reality that he would become man to save man. You think about the daily life that he lived on the earth in the flesh, and it was very similar to what we experience day to day. Now, I know there's a lot of things change. We have a lot of things that are different about our life today than what he would have experienced in 25 AD. But fundamentally, we're the same. We're still humans, created by God for the purpose of serving God, and Jesus was given an earthly body to serve God as well. We face fears and frustrations. We face struggles and trials, and we face temptation, and we face difficulties. And Jesus, in many ways, dealt with all of those same things. This has been one of those sermons to me that I just have really wrestled with. Just tried to wrap my mind around. Felt like I was hitting my head against the wall for a month now, because I've been working on this sermon for a month. And Russ had stopped by. How's it going? I don't know, man. I don't know if it's going well. I got 2 points, all we're going to talk about this morning. The first one is just how human he really was. And the second one is why that matters. So I want us to consider truly the depths of his humanity. The fact that he experienced childhood and he experienced teenage years. He experienced manhood. And really that begins with Matthew chapter 1 and Luke chapter 3. And we're not going to look at all of these passages. Mostly we're going to refer to them. But in Matthew chapter 1 and Luke chapter 3, you have the birth of Jesus Christ. Birth of Jesus of Nazareth. And when we look at those passages, we often look at the fact that he connects to David and he is in line to the Davidic throne. He's the rightful heir, the rightful king. And we talk about how he connects to Abraham and how he is the fulfillment of the seed promise that Abraham was given in Genesis 12. And all of those things are very, very important that we remember because they are a part of his identity and who he is and what he came to do while he was on the earth. But one thing we often don't think about from that passage, Matthew 1, Luke 3, is that he was born. That there was a baby boy born to Mary, born to Joseph, that needed to be rocked and needed to be comforted, that Mary nursed as a baby. We sometimes disconnect all of these things from who he is because we're so often thinking about the big picture stuff. But you know, Paul talked about the birth of Jesus. In Galatians chapter 4, he said, when the fullness of time had come, God sent forth his son, born of a woman, born under the law. His conception was certainly miraculous, folks, but his birth, by all accounts, is natural. He was born to a woman. And he was a baby in her arms. He experienced growth. I want you to turn to Luke chapter 2. In Luke chapter 2, this is really the only scene we have of Jesus between being a toddler and beginning his preaching at about 30. But in Luke chapter 2, his parents were very religious individuals, and they take into Jerusalem to take care or to take part of the Passover feast. And when they begin journeying home, they realize Jesus is not with them. And they go back and find him. In verse 48, Mary, I think in some ways, scolds him a little bit. Verse 48, she says to Jesus, "Son, why have you done this to us? Look, your father and I have sought you anxiously." And of course, his response is, "How is it that you've sought me? Do you not know that I must be about my father's business?" They did not understand the statement which he spoke to them. But verse 51, "And he went down with them and came to Nazareth and was subject to them, but his mother kept all these things in her heart." I often think about what a 12-year-old Jesus would have been like. Evidently, he realized some aspects of who he is, if not all aspects of who he is, even at that point, because of the statement about being about his father's work. But you realize he was a child. He was a 12-year-old boy who had earthly parents. He had the experience of subjecting himself to their authoritative role in his life. I was considering some of the implications of some of his life on the earth. You realize that this is the only human who ever lived who could answer the questions God presents to Job. When Job is having the discussion with God, and God finally speaks to Job in Job 38 beginning, and he starts asking him the questions about basically, where were you when I set the foundations of the world? Job, you think you're this, you think you're that, but you're nothing because I am God. Jesus is the only human who ever lived who could answer those questions, who knew the answers Job did not. And he subjected himself to his parents. He experienced growing up. He experienced growth pains. He lived and breathed and operated as a small teenage boy. You know, I often think about what it would have been like to have been his parents, to have been Mary and Joseph, even in Luke chapter 2. You ever have a kid get lost in Walmart? I have not experienced that yet, but I've got a vulture death grip on both my girls when we step out of the car anywhere in public because, well, you've seen them. I mean, they're just, it's like trying to catch ants. So I don't let go of them. But, you know, imagine being them. This is a child that God has entrusted to you. Folks, it's the Son of God. And they have to keep him safe. They have to raise him, have to nurture him, have to maybe discipline him. They had to discipline him at some point. You ever feel ill-equipped to be a parent? You ever feel like you're inadequate as a parent? How do you think they felt? Now, I want you to kind of take a step back and think about it. Do you approach parenting with the level of appreciation that you are raising this child because this child was given to you by God? Now, I'm not saying your child's the prophet. I'm not saying your child's the Christ. But your child was given to you by God. Do you approach that with that level of appreciation, realizing that someday this child goes back to God? Man, that's a high level of responsibility. But his parents lived through that same thing, reasoning through themselves the same thought process. And along that same line, he had that earthly family. In Mark chapter 6 and in Matthew chapter 13, the Jews are reasoning who he should be or who he is. They said, "Is this not Jesus? He's the son of Mary. He's the son of Joseph. His brothers are James and Judas and Simon and James. His sisters are here with us too." He had an earthly family. He understood the family dynamic. Just like we do. Just like every one of us who have siblings do. I've got 5 brothers. I understand the family dynamic. I'm the second oldest. He was the eldest child. You realize that he not only had a family, but he understands what it's like to experience family that doesn't believe. I want you to turn to John chapter 7. In John chapter 7, you have this, what I think is one of the saddest interactions of Jesus on the earth with any human. But in John chapter 7, his brothers come to him. The Feast of the Tabernacles was at hand. In verse 3, His brothers therefore said to him, "Depart from here, go into Judea, that your disciples also may see the works that you're doing. For no one does anything in secret while he himself seeks to be known openly. If you do these things, show yourself to the world." Notice this, though. "For not even his brothers believed in him." Jesus was 30 years old when he began preaching. The oldest sibling, the oldest child in the home. You realize he grew up with these kids, these boys, these brothers of his. You know how much it hurts you to have a family member who doesn't believe in God? How much do you think it must have hurt him to have family that didn't believe him to be the Christ? Now, I have no idea what they grew up hearing. I think there's some indications in the text, in other places, what they grew up hearing. But I don't know what all they were told in the home. I don't know what Mary and Joseph told them. I don't know if they talked about some of this stuff. All I know is they heard some of the preaching Jesus did, and his brothers evidently didn't believe him. You just go show them up there what you're doing. Just go show them who you are if you're so good. How would you handle an older sibling saying he's God? We talked about that in the high school class this morning, and you should have seen the reaction some of the kids had. "Ooh, yeah, my older brother's God. Yeah, I'd believe that." Yeah, I mean, it's the same thing all of us would probably approach that issue with. His own brothers didn't believe him. You know, in Mark 6, he's called the son of the carpenter. He grew up working with his dad. You know, my dad has done heat and air work since he was 18 years old. Went into business for himself, and I cannot tell you how many times I was with my dad at 9 o'clock at night, somewhere on top of a roof, holding a flashlight, looking at some silly heat and air unit that needed to be fixed right then. Oh, I hated those days. You realize that he would have grown up with experiences similar to that? Not with a flashlight, obviously. Not with a heat and air unit, obviously. But he would have grown up working with his dad. He's called the son of the carpenter. He knew what it was like to step back and help his dad move these beams around, move this wood around, build this little bit of furniture, whatever it was, doing carpentry work. Sometimes I don't think we realize how much of the human experience that Jesus did partake in. He understood what it's like to live in a community. In the Mark 6 section, he talks about his own country. Matthew 13 talks about his own country. Nazareth. He understands what it's like to grow up in a community of people who know him, who interact with him. He had small talk with people. We always read the large talk he had, the big talk, big conversations, important details, because that's what we have recorded. But you know, he had the pleasantries with individuals, interacted with them, ran into them in public. You know, that happens occasionally here. I ran into Galen at Academy a few weeks ago. It happens here. But imagine a community like Nazareth. He was well known by these people, which in some ways makes it even sadder that he was rejected by them. He understood what it was like to have nationalism. Of course, him being a son of Abraham himself, but in John chapter 8, he talks about he is the one who existed before Abraham. I am. Remember that whole statement? Right before that, the Jews are berating him about some of this stuff, and they're saying, "You just say what you want to say, but we're sons of Abraham." What's it like to grow up in the United States? Have that kind of pride that comes with living as an American? Or in the South? Or in Texas? He understood what it was like to have that pride. It influenced all the aspects of his daily life. You think he understood what it was like to be oppressed? To have a governmental force threatening his religious freedoms, which thankfully we really haven't experienced. You realize when he lived on the earth, the entire time he lived on the earth, that entire region was ruled by Rome. And they had placed the Herods in charge of all of that area. In fact, when they go to crucify him, the Jews have to go and talk to Pilate, the Roman official, before they can get permission to kill him, because they couldn't do that without Rome's approval. You understood that he faced these things, that he was concerned about the way things were going, that he dealt with what it was like to live in this physical world, that he had to wake up and go to a job at different times. In fact, in Mark 6, he's just called the carpenter, not even the carpenter's son. Folks, at 30 years old, when he began his preaching, he would have been working. It wasn't like it is today where you get out of school at 18 and you go to college for 4, 5, 6, 7 years, and then you get out of that and you work then. At 30 years old, he was already known as a carpenter. He was part of the workforce. He understood what it was like to sweat and to toil under the sun, to get up and have to go to a job, to whatever degree that was. Sometimes we disconnect who he was every day to who we read about in the scriptures, and we don't sometimes see the connection to who we are today. But he experienced all aspects of humanity. You realize he had physical needs, and he faced sickness. Go back to Hebrews 2. Hebrews chapter 2. And our memory verse. Hebrews chapter 2 and verse 14. Inasmuch then as the children have partaken of flesh and blood, he also himself likewise shared in the same. You think about the implications of that text. Everybody in here has faced sickness. I've thrown up, I've ran fever. And when I do, just take me out in the back pasture and shoot me. I am the worst person when I'm sick. You realize he would have faced aspects of that. Because every human, no matter how healthy you are, has faced sickness, has faced the stomach bug, has faced those fevers, has faced headaches or whatever it was. You realize he would have experienced aspects of that. To me, that's one of those ones that just really impresses me. Because if I was given the option to never be sick again and not have to live, I probably would take it. But he came knowing that he was going to subject himself to these things. He faced hunger. In John chapter 4, when he's talking to the woman at the well, the disciples go into town to get him food. Because he's hungry. He faced thirst. Same story with the woman at the well. When he asked her to draw him up some water. When he's hanging on the cross, he asks for something to drink. He faced those same needs that you and I have. He faced emotions like we have. In John chapter 11, when he hears the news of Lazarus, he cries because it broke his heart. When he looks at the rich young ruler in Mark chapter 10, it records that he looked on him and he loved him. Certainly God had experienced love before. That's why he sent Christ in the first place, was because of love. But I'm talking about a human emotion. When he looks at the rich young ruler, he faced sorrow. In Matthew chapter 23, he talks about Jerusalem and he talks about how often he wanted to gather Jerusalem up like a hen gathers her chicks, but they wouldn't do it. They wouldn't let him. They wouldn't let him help them. You know, that's a level of sorrow that sometimes we can't appreciate. Because he sees all of the picture. He sees everything. He sees every person who's falling away. He sees every person who's breaking his heart. We just see what's around us. But does that not affect you when somebody won't repent? Does that not have a toll on you? Imagine being him. Imagine knowing the hearts and intentions of the people he's talking to. And no matter how hard he preaches this sermon, no matter how intentional he is with trying to get them to understand this point, he knows at the end of the sermon, no matter what he says, they're not going to accept what he had to say. You know how hard that is? Russ and I have talked about some of the challenges we face as gospel preachers. I'm not discouraged as a preacher. And thankfully, I've really not faced a lot of discouragement, just from my preaching perspective. But you imagine being the man who came to the earth to die for these people and preach these sermons to them, to hear at the end of them every single time, not interested. And yet he faced that sort of discouragement. He faced suffering. In Luke chapter 9, he talks about the disciple comes to him and wants to follow him, and he says that I have nowhere to lay my head at night. Homeless. Has no place where he can wind down. Every person in this room has a home. Every person in this room has their little place they get to go to get away from the world and away from society, to wind down, to relax, to just de-stress. You know, it doesn't seem like Christ had anything like that while He was on the earth. He faced rejection, Luke 4, by His own country, who pushed Him to the edge of the cliff because they didn't believe who He was, want to kill Him, and He walks through them unscathed because it wasn't time to die yet. You ever been rejected by your entire community? Sure, every one of us have faced rejection in a limited sense, but have you faced rejection from your entire community, the place you call home? You guys that live in Sour Lake especially, or out in Lumberton. Maybe not Beaumont. That'd be pretty bad to have the whole city of Beaumont hate your guts. But imagine living in a smaller community where everybody knows everybody, the community you grew up in, and yet they hate your guts. And they push you out of the synagogue wanting to drive you off of a cliff. Have you faced discouragement like that? Have you faced hardships like that? He understood what it's like to lose loved ones. With Lazarus in John 11, but even with John the Baptizer. You know, a cousin of his being killed. And I think by all indications of the text, I think that Joseph was probably dead by the time he started preaching. Because of a lot of reasons. I won't dig into all of them, but because of several reasons in the New Testament. You realize that he experienced what it's like to lose people. Not just to sin, I'm not saying sin, but physically lose people. And the toll that takes on a person. You realize that he faced temptation. Now, we talk about this one quite a bit. When he's presented with all the opportunities the devil gives to him in John or in Matthew chapter 4, he's presented with all of these sins that the devil wants to get him to fall prey to, selfishness and pride and carnality, and yet he doesn't give in to any of them. He faced the temptation of sexual sins. Hebrews chapter 4 and verse 15, he was tempted in all things as we are, and yet was without sin. I want you to think about that when you think about the little boy in Luke chapter 12. He went through teenage years and faced the temptations that all of us face. The whole craze of boys will be boys. No. You know what? I reject that statement. Boys will be boys. Raise a little boy to be a man one day. Jesus lived through all of these things. Jesus lived through all these temptations, and certainly He was God, and certainly there might have been some things that He understood better than we do a lot of times, but He lived through these things and did not give in to temptation. You parents that are raising boys, raise them to be men like Christ. Now, sometimes we feel like that's setting the bar too high. It's unreasonable to attain to. You want them to grow up one day and be Christ-like, don't you? Isn't that your goal as a person, as a Christian, is to be more like Christ? It's our theme this year that's not on the board anymore. That's our theme this year, is to be more about Christ so we can be more like Christ. Raise young men to grow up and be a man like Christ was. He set the example for all of us, folks. You know, these kids, these little boys, and I'm talking little boys, I'm saying Arliss's age all the way up to Connor. Who do you want to be like when you grow up? Now, I want you to stop and think about it, and I want you boys to listen to me, all of you, young men. Let's say you're young men, that make you feel better. Young men, listen to me for just a second. Who do you want to be like when you grow up? Who do you think about as he's a real man? Let me tell you something about real men. Real men might could bench 500-600 pounds. I don't know if that's even possible. Certainly not for me, okay? Real men might can lift heavy weights. They might can ride horses, and they might can rope, and they might play football. They might be married. They might not be married. They might have kids. They might not have kids. Let me tell you what a real man will be. Loyal. Be faithful to God. Be devoted to the family. Now, you might can look to your dad for some of those things, but I want to encourage you, young men, look at Christ. And while you're raising your daughters, raise them to want men like Christ. Raise them to set their bar high because Christ set the bar for all of us. Sometimes that stuff makes us uncomfortable to think about. Folks, that's the goal of each and every one of us in here, is to be more like Christ. To be the kind of individual that He was. Not shy away from the truth, but pursue it. Treat it like a fine treasure you don't want to give away. You know, He was tempted beyond just those things. He was tempted to compromise the truth. And despite all of His preaching, He would not bend. He would not give way on the truth. When you stand up today, and I'm not talking about preachers, I'm talking about all of you. When you stand up today and you say things like baptism is for the remission of your sins and it is necessary to go to heaven, you stand up today and draw some hard lines on modesty, draw some hard lines on homosexuality or sexuality in general, you're going to make some enemies. You go read some of Matthew's sermons that he records of Jesus preaching, Matthew 5, 6, and 7, and you think about how hard those things were to take. And yet Jesus does not compromise, and He does not back away from the truth. He presents it because it's the truth. You know, these are all temptations that you and I can understand, but you imagine the temptations He faced we can't sympathize with. The temptation to use His power when the devil presents those things, it's turn the stones to bread. It's the temptation to come off the cross. When those who ridicule Him say, if you are the Christ, if you're the Christ, why don't you save yourself? If you are the Christ, why don't you come down from the cross? You know what a temptation that might have been to Him? But He was resolved to be faithful. Injustices and cruelties of every kind. The mock trial, the scourgings that came after, and the crucifixion that came after that. And yet He faced all of that, guys, as a man. Now, I know that took a while. Point two. Here's why it matters. I got three simple points for you, all from Hebrews chapter 2, and I want to begin by reading this text. Hebrews chapter 2 and verse 10. For it was fitting for Him, for whom are all things, and by whom are all things, in bringing many sons to glory, to make the author of their salvation perfect through sufferings. For both He who sanctifies and those who are being sanctified are all of one. For which reason He is not ashamed to call them brethren, saying, I will declare your name to my brethren. In the midst of the church I will sing praise to you. And again I will put my trust in Him. And again, here am I and the children whom God has given to me. Inasmuch then as the children have partaken of flesh and blood, He also Himself likewise shared in the same, that through death He might destroy him who had the power of death, that is, the devil, and deliver those who through fear of death were all their lifetime subject to bondage. For indeed He does not give help to angels, but He does give help to the seed of Abraham. Therefore in all things He was obligated to be made like His brethren, that He might be a merciful and faithful high priest in things pertaining to God, to make propitiation for the sins of the people. For in that He Himself has suffered, being tempted, He is able to aid those who are tempted. We spent a lot of time talking about how truly human He was. I got three reasons why it matters, all right here in Hebrews chapter 2. First one is He saves us from destruction. I want you to look again at verse 10, the statement being made there, the very end of verse 10. He's been made the author of their salvation, perfect through sufferings. His sacrificial work was to this end, salvation, that He might save us from destruction. He might save us and give us hope, give us a home. I don't know if we always really appreciate how truly qualified He is to lead us. Folks, He's qualified to lead humanity because He understands completely what humanity is like. Because He knows perfectly what it is to be human and to serve as a human. I don't know if we always appreciate that. That little statement there in verse 10, He is the author of our salvation. Now, I know there's a lot of other translations that read that otherwise, but I like the poetic value to the word author. You realize Jesus Christ wrote the greatest love story ever told? The story of Christ and His bride, the church, that He died to save. That's why I call it a love story. You realize that that story is about him, the hero, and you and me. Folks, his humanity and how truly human he was is how he could save us from destruction. It's how he could fulfill the obligations of being the perfect sacrifice, being the one without spot and without blemish. It's how he could blaze the trail for us. In John chapter 1, verses 4 and 5, it talks about how in him was the life, and his life was the light of men. He's the trailblazer. He paved the way so that we could follow him. Also, he could save us from destruction. Number two, he saves us from alienation. This is all throughout this text here. There's familial language. What I mean by that is, you'll see the references. He talks about the sons of glory in verse 10, but verse 11, for both he who sanctifies and those who are being sanctified are all of one, for which reason he is not ashamed to call them brethren. Down in verse 17, therefore in all things he was obligated to be made like his brethren, that he might be a merciful and faithful high priest in things pertaining to God to make propitiation for the sins of the people. Folks, the work and sacrifice of Jesus Christ is what made the family of God a reality. It's what made it possible. It's what made it happen. It made him qualified to save us in a different way. Hebrews says a lot about the qualifications of Christ as high priest. Folks, that's what makes him such an exceptional high priest. He knows what it's like to be you. He knows what it's like to face the things you face. He can perfectly represent you to the Father as the great mediator between God and men because he was a man at one point. So he can serve between you and the Father. And we can have confidence in him. That statement, he's not ashamed to call them brethren. You know why that is? Because the brethren are striving for holiness, and he achieved it. He's not ashamed to have this association. He's not ashamed to have this relationship because we're striving to follow him. We're striving to be like him. In all this work, he shared his birthright, and he shared the blessing with us. Do we stop and appreciate the family that God has given? There's a statement I think that really comes out in this text, although it's not used. Belonging. He gives us a sense of belonging. You don't belong anywhere else. You don't belong in this world. You don't belong in Beaumont. You don't belong in the community. You don't belong in your career of choice. I don't care how perfect you are for it. You don't belong there. You know where you do belong? In a relationship with God the Father through Christ the Son. That's where you belong. You want to talk about belonging in our society? You don't belong there. We need to make sure our kids understand that, folks, because they'll never fit in. But we're not called to fit in here. We're called to be holy. Number three, we're wrapping it up. He saves us from temptation. This little section talks about some different things. In verse 14, he's partaken of flesh, he shared in the same, that through death he might destroy him who had the power of death, that is the devil, and deliver those who through fear of death were all their lifetime subject to bondage. Jump down to verse 18. For in that he himself has suffered being tempted, he's able to aid those who are tempted. Folks, Jesus saves us from the power of death. 1 Corinthians 15 talks a little bit about that with the resurrection. Death has no sting, Hades has no victory. But further than that, he saved us from the fear of death. I don't know if a lot of Christians are afraid of dying. I think that oftentimes we are afraid of dying. I wonder if it's more of the unknown that scares us. But we don't do that with any other thing. I've flirted with the idea of taking the children, I'm going to speak in code so they don't hear me, taking the children to Disney World. There's a lot of unknowns when you take two small children on a 7-day trip to Disney World. But the things you do know about that, they overshadow the things you don't know. The excitement of being there, the excitement of that trip, the excitement of having all that fun overshadows the fear of what might be uncomfortable on that trip, because there'd be plenty of things uncomfortable. But do we not realize that heaven is like that? There's a lot of things we don't know about death. There's a lot of things we don't know about the final days. But let me tell you, what we do know should outweigh anything that keeps us afraid. The things we do know about heaven, the things we do know about our eternal home, the place we're supposed to be, the place we're striving to get to, that ought to give us the confidence to not be afraid of death. He saves us from the temptation of fear in general. We're supposed to be Christians who aren't afraid, right? Let me tell you something you should be afraid of. You should be afraid of not entering that rest. That's Hebrews 4. You should be afraid of letting God down. That's Hebrews 5 and Hebrews 12. That fear should drive you. And of course, you shouldn't be afraid of anything else. The book of Hebrews is about the confidence and hope we can have in Jesus Christ as our perfect and great high priest. He is a perfect helper. He is a perfect sympathizer. And because of His work as our high priest, we can come boldly to the throne of God. We can be confident that we can receive grace and mercy in our time of need. Why? Because of Him. And because of who He is. Because of what He did while He was on the earth. This should give us the confidence we need. It should serve as an encouragement to us that He lived like we do. But I'm going to tell you something, folks. It should serve as a warning to us, too. He showed you how to live a life full, a life glorifying the Father. Have you been paying attention? Have you been thinking about what He did? Have you been trying to follow in His example? If we can help you this morning, because you've not done that before, we want to help you. And if you've done that before and have went back into this world, well, we're still wanting to help you. He is the way, the truth, and the life. And if we can help you come to Him this morning, we'd invite you to come forward now as we stand and as we sing.